Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. Today's show is special. We're at or near the end of the year and the holidays are upon us. We've done some great shows this year and recently been given great opportunities with great guests. Consider this show to be along those same lines, a great guest and a great subject, a tough, challenging, and almost taboo subject, but important. Also important this time of year is to give, without expectation. Today's guest is Cecile Schreshta. Cecile is the Director of Philanthropy at nonprofit WaterAid. WaterAid needs your attention and they deserve it. WaterAid ranks highly on charitynavigator.org and is one of the world's most efficient nonprofits, returning over 82% directly to programs, accountability, and transparency in their fine efforts. Consider, please, a donation at this time of year to WaterAid, but please consider something else, too. One person in three lacks access to adequate sanitation. The result is widespread death and disease, especially among children, and social marginalization. Women are particularly vulnerable. Poor sanitation exposes females to the risk of assault, and when schools cannot provide clean, safe toilets, girls' attendance drops. Join me in welcoming to the show Cecile Schreshta. Born and raised in Nepal, Cecile joined WaterAid in 2015. And she brings over 12 years of experience in international development with her. At WaterAid, she manages key relationships with supporters through events, outreach, and board development. Ms. Schreshta has an MA, and she is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate from the University of California at San Diego. Cecile's work and her story are amazing. Again, please consider a donation to WaterAid on behalf of safe, clean water for drinking and cleaning. Cecile Schreshta, thank you for joining us today via Skype. From your website and your excellent media relations manager, Alana Imbach, I've learned a lot of things about WaterAid America. We're going to talk about a bunch of that stuff, but I think some of the things that my audience might be very surprised to learn, and certainly I'd love to get your reaction to this, and that is that one in three women worldwide, almost are risking shame, disease, attack on a daily basis because they just have no place to go, no place safe to go to the restroom. And then of that number, 526 million have no choice but to use outdoor open toilets, and that these same women and girls, primarily they're women and girls, spend 97 billion, that's billion with a B, hours each year finding those outdoor places to go. You've written about this subject. You've even lived some of this. You're from Nepal. And certainly, I'm curious about some of your experiences visiting Nepal recently and meeting some of these young girls that are living with these dangers. What is it that they're living with, and why is this such a big worldwide issue?
Great, Paul. Well, thank you first of all for having me. I'm very pleased to be here. As you rightly noted, I work at WaterAid here, based in New York. I am originally Nepali, so my father is Nepali and my mother is American, and I was born and raised in Kathmandu. However, my experience was nothing like the girls that I have, worked with or witnessed, and I think that's where the impetus comes from. The passion is that I grew up relatively privileged in Kathmandu, went to the international school, and had, access that girls do not have. In my various stints in my career with the UN, ActionAid, and now with WaterAid, I've gone back to kind of experience firsthand what the girls are going through. And it's really something that I wasn't quite exposed to growing up, but now it's become really my passion issue. I would say, in general, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. One, Nepal is the experience of Nepali women is very diverse. So Nepal is mostly rural, and as people know, we have the Himalayas, and the topography is very difficult. So the experience of the women is very different based on if they're in a rural part of the country or an urban part of the country. So that's one kind of thing I would preface, that the experience of a woman in Kathmandu, like myself, growing up is very different from the experience of a woman growing up in a rural community. So that's very important to keep in mind. Often the realities don't even, translate. We're going to focus on rural women because that's the experience that is most, alarming, and people don't know about it. And I've spent my work going into water aid communities to kind of expose the issues, talk about the issues, shed some light on what's going on, and give face to the problems. So focusing on young girls and women. Living in New York, having, traveled the world, it really is hard for us to really understand what's going on in these communities. It really is quite a dire place to grow up as a woman. Absolutely, they do not have access to basic necessities, human rights. Water is far and few between, the access to toilets, which I think is very hard for us to conceive of. If you just imagine one day in your apartment or your home without one, access to water that's running, and then without a toilet, how it would impact your daily life. So these girls are, facing these realities on a day-to-day basis. I will also say that they actually don't really know what it would be like to grow up with running water in a toilet. So it's, Nepali women are incredibly resilient, and they just live their lives bearing the brunt of many things without complaints. So it's how they've been, raised. The society is incredibly patriarchal, so women are generally raised to listen to first their fathers as they're growing up, and then they are passed on through marriage, and their husbands have a lot of control. So the often the experience of a woman in Nepal or a young girl is, I like to say, voiceless. And what I'm trying to do is give voice to the voiceless because they have no outlet or no way to speak or communicate. So really the experience of girls in these marginalized rural communities is very harsh. However, they have, that's all they know. And we have to be careful about how we raise awareness. We cannot go into these communities telling them, the Western experience is the correct experience. We have to be very sensitive to the context and the sensitivities with culture and religion.
And as you suggest, Nepal is particularly challenged because of topography and other issues. But talk for a second more about the patriarchy subject, because values, norms, boys and girls literally have different roles. This is something that is part of, maybe not part of what life is like in Kathmandu, but certainly it's very much a part of what life is like in some of these rural areas. And the rural areas are the areas that are the most subject to this lack of sanitation, lack of water, and lack of hygiene.
Indeed. The patriarchy is pervasive, and I will say it's throughout the country, so it's more extreme or harsh in terms of the way it manifests in, marginalized communities. However, it exists in Kathmandu. I personally did not grow up with it because I grew up in a very enlightened household with, I went to the international school. So my father, who is very much Nepali, was incredibly liberated, educated. However, at one point in my life, I did live in a household. I was married to a Nepali who comes from an incredibly traditional background, and his family incredibly traditional. So I think part of the passion comes from the firsthand experience of what it's like to even be a woman living in Kathmandu in these kind of patriarchal homes. And I will preface that with, the women eat last. They serve the men. They take care of all the household duties, all the religious stuff. And often, my experience was that the men are served, and they are the managers of the household, and the women just kind of patter around and serve them. And it was very interesting experience for me, coming from more an international American background, that it does indeed exist. And that is often what is expected of women. Of course, it's changing. However, I was able to more understand how a girl growing up, in the far west could be treated in her household, in her community. They really don't have that much power or a voice to speak out or question their families or question their fathers. And also to say that often these prejudices and the patriarchy and the customs are very often perpetuated by the women themselves. And there's many reasons reasons for that. That can be, you know, lack of awareness, lack of education. Often the women have experienced it themselves and have been exposed to these customs. So it's just, it really takes time and, you know, education and generational change. So my grandmother tried to impose, so my grandmother, my Nepali grandmother, who's now 93, survived the earthquake of 1934 and survived the recent earthquake in April of 2015. That was the 7.9. So her stories are incredible. Now, she, of course, comes from a different mindset and understanding. So she did try to impose certain traditions on me. When girls go through, you know, adolescence, there are certain customs that I myself went through. When I was six, I was taken to the temple, and there was, I was married to a god in this, in the form of a fruit, in case that I was ever widowed or, you know, in an instance where I didn't have a man attached to me, I would have some form of protection. So that was not a very severe practice. However, when girls go through their first menstruation, they're kept in a dark room for 12 days. As they're kind of coming to age, and they're not allowed to see any of their male family members. And my mother intervened and said, absolutely not, I will not allow Cecile to go through with this practice. And my father agreed. So, you know, very keeping in mind that generations past have had certain customs, and it just takes time and education. And many girls now do not go through that custom, but it still exists. So,
yeah. And this is the practice. This is the practice that's known in Nepal as, you have to correct my pronunciation, but this is chapati, is that right?
Am I saying? No, I'm so sorry. That chapati is actually the practice of when girls are secluded in the actual physical infrastructure of an outhouse or a hut.
That's okay.
Yeah.
And so it's that practice that becomes so glaring, really, with lack of water, the sanitation that comes with that, and the lack of running water and toilets. And it's during this period, during this adolescence, this this menstruation period, that the girls are even opting out of education. And is that going on in rural parts of the country?
That is definitely an experience that is primarily rural. Because we see the schools that are out in the rural communities are less equipped with the facilities that are, you know, hygienic for a girl,
bathrooms, safe for a girl, privacy,
and that are clean, exactly, and private, you know, have locked doors, have places so they can dispose of their sanitary materials like incinerators or anything that is, you know, that will make it conducive for them to actually attend school. So we do see many girls at that age dropping out of school. And in Kathmandu itself, girls do miss school when they're going through some of the seclusion, or they're going through that first practice where they're kept in rooms for the 12 days. But I would say the most extreme form of when we see girls missing out on school are in the rural communities, because the facilities really are not up to par, and there aren't toilets and running water, so they don't really have options.
And so sometimes even those educational options aren't available, because they're not even in school. The girls aren't even in school necessarily to even receive those messages. I've read material online that you've written, Cecile, and I think my audience would be very interested in doing so too. And we'll put up quotes. We're, of course, with Cecile Shrestha from WaterAid, and Cecile is the director of philanthropy there. One of the quotes from you that I thought was just very moving and may come as a shock to some, I'd like to read it, and then I'd like to get your reaction today to what you wrote in 2015. You said, "Women and girls the whole world over menstruate each month. It is part of a universally shared experience that transcends all boundaries, but most of us aren't marched off to jail-like sheds and forced into frightening seclusion just because we're menstruating."
Yes, indeed. I will say that even in events we do in New York City or in the U.S., we're talking about how this is an issue that no one talks about. More and more it's growing. However, it's uncomfortable for even us living in New York City.
Even in the U.S.
Even in the U.S., even in our office where we have perfect, wonderful facilities, it does impede somewhat of your daily life when you're working. It's not comfortable, you're in pain, it's uneasy, it's not always something that you want to share with your colleagues. So it's already difficult and kind of a nuisance for us. So imagine for a young girl who doesn't have understanding of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Then she's being secluded and told that she's impure and dirty, and she cannot touch her family members, and she can't eat with the family, and she cannot touch the water sources. So,
and she's isolated from her family during this period, and even from the kitchen and from livestock, and it really very much is a seclusion.
It's absolutely a seclusion, and the urban form is less severe. So you may be sleeping in a separate room in the house itself or not going into the kitchen. But out in the rural communities, you are actually sent out into these sheds that are completely removed from the homes and the livestock. And the sheds are not protected. They're barely walls and they're barely roofs. And the girl that I saw out when I went with NPR, I was absolutely mortified. It was torrentially raining. I went during the monsoon, which is a terrible time to go, very unsafe. It was very difficult to get there. We had to fly, which is very dangerous in Nepal, and then take a 2-hour drive. And then the road was kind of washing away. So we had to walk up to this community 9 hours. So that experience for those girls is the most extreme. And I have never seen that. And many people in the capital will have never seen a shed. They're almost, it's like almost an urban myth. So seeing that was very shocking, and how she was sleeping completely unprotected, drenched in the rain, and then they're worried about passersby, they're worried about snakes. I was worried about snakes. It's a horrible experience. So already something that is difficult for women and young girls, now it's exacerbated by all these other factors. Mm-hmm. And more than anything, it's what it does to a girl's psyche and her sense of dignity. Mm-hmm. And you know, upbringing, that she is considered a curse. And, you know, she shouldn't touch anyone because she will anger, upset the gods, and her family members will die or fall sick, or the goats will die. It's just, it's so hard to fathom, actually, what has gone into the practice and why these girls continue to suffer. And it's happening because just recently, as we all know, a girl died in a menstrual shed in far western Nepal, and it has kind of created another surge in this topic, because it's just hard for people to conceive of what is going on.
You're referring to the news reports, really, and this was, I believe this was April, is that right? And a young girl was found dead in one of the huts, and some of these huts are referred to as goths, and so do we know what the cause of death was for this young girl that was found? Was it hygienic related?
It's a good question. We actually do not know. I have spoken with WaterAid people as well as my own contacts, who have contacts with the journalists there in the district. The last I've heard, they have not been able to identify the cause. The Prime Minister's office is involved, because we have to keep in mind that this tradition is against the law.
Mm-hmm. This is unlawful.
2005,
it's been upheld by the Nepal Supreme Court, and the Prime Minister is involved.
Correct. In 2005, it was outlawed. But we have to, you know, keep in mind that you can establish all these laws, but the enforcement, mm-hmm. is very difficult in a country that is so separated and the communities are so marginalized by the topography, mm-hmm. and the mountains. And just getting there is so challenging.
Mm-hmm. Through the jungle, really. I mean, it looked like from the pictures on your blog that this was really jungle that you were trekking through.
Yeah, trekking through it was very traumatic. As we were walking, you know, up and down, the roads were literally washing away. There was a point coming down with the NPR journalists that I thought, okay, well, this is it. Because we were caught in a monsoon torrential downpour, and the road was literally washing away, and we were worried about there being a landslide. And, you know, we're on foot. Woman I traveled with, she also has traveled the world and been to the Amazon, and she said it was the most traumatic, difficult trip she's ever done. I will agree that I have traveled much of Nepal, I have trekked, I have worked in these communities, but it was definitely the most trying for me as well, just in terms of the conditions and the heat and then the rain, and we had to sleep outside, and then the snakes, and then seeing what we saw, which was so upsetting and traumatic. It was eye-opening and mind-blowing for me, and I grew up in the country, so mm-hmm.
And here you are, college educated, and you think, and you mentioned this too just a moment ago, at a 12-year-old girl walking around in these same kinds of circumstances with weather and animals, snakes, and just the pure trauma of this isolation. Are there physical attacks that take place on these, unprotected and vulnerable young girls out there as well?
Yes, absolutely. We gathered a bunch of girls in the village I was in, and they, you know, kept referencing one girl who'd been raped in a hut. And I know during the Civil War, when, you know, the country was going through a civil war, and there were, you know, guerrillas on one side and the army on one side, there were, you know, atrocities committed against women on both sides. And, you know, these girls are exposed. They have no protection whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine how fearful it is for them. Mm-hmm. That now has subsided. But yes, absolutely. A bunch of drunk guys passing by a hut with a lonesome girl, anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's very unsettling.
Well, Cecile Schrester, what will help? Certainly what will help from programs like this, is it just going to be clean water and toilets? Is that what's going to help these young girls, in this adolescent period through menstruation? What is it that WaterAid would like us to do? What coming from the country as you have, what would you say to my audience that here are two things or three things, or here's one thing that you can do to really help this situation now?
Well, if I may, just provide some context around what WaterAid does in these communities.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
It has to be absolutely like a twofold intervention. So one is the actual hardware intervention. So that's actually building the toilets, providing the water, and providing the correct facilities.
That's
that are
kind of
safe
plumbing. Is that really the infrastructure you're referring to?
Yeah, the plumbing, mm-hmm. the construction of toilets, the incinerators, the actual mm-hmm. locks on the doors. But what I think we really are focusing on more and more is that software intervention of really the education piece,
mm-hmm.
raising awareness, spreading awareness, talking about it. And we work a lot through schools because,
mm-hmm.
as we know, young people are, the agents of change. We're talking to girls in schools, talking to boys in schools about these issues and how we can combat them, and including them in the actual education of, in the actual, in the books, and creating ways that we can create, have these interventions, whether it's through the arts or the actual books. So I would say supporting organizations like WaterAid that understand how complex the issue is and how we have to do the proper kind of intervention that requires both elements of hard and software. And really what we always say is spend your time talking about the issue. Spend your talent. Do you have any kind of exposure or contacts? Can you raise the issue in other ways? And of course, your money is always appreciated, because if you give it to the correct organizations like WaterAid, you know that they're doing the right kind of intervention,
mm-hmm.
working with the local communities, doing sustainable interventions, understanding the complexities and sensitivities, and doing a long-term approach, both in terms of education and infrastructure. And, at a time like now in December, I would say just understanding the issues, talking about it, and donating, because it is the end of the year, and
mm-hmm.
donating to causes and organizations that you trust, like WaterAid, that you know they're going to do right by you with your money and your contribution.
And WaterAid is rated very highly worldwide with its ratios of funds that go towards actual results and creating some of this change. I think one of the things that I gave some thought to as I was looking through the website and all of your material, and that was, the young girls themselves, are they advocating, on their almost on their own behalf? Are they creating this awareness? I understand, and I found some wonderful resources on the website WaterAid.org for instruction in educational settings. But what are the young girls themselves doing? And do they feel so shamed that they don't want to take a public position on this? Are they actively working, and maybe there's somewhere in between that they all kind of fit?
It's a really good question, and of course the answer is that it depends. It really
mm-hmm.
depends on the household in which they've been raised. So we see, or what I experienced with, for example, Kamala, who was the girl that we featured in the NPR story. Now
mm-hmm.
she comes from a more her mother was not educated, and they had, you know, they had barely any resources. She seemed brainwashed and very much followed the tradition. And when we asked her to come over to us to talk to us, she was even shy to come over because she was crossing that boundary. So she was very much, you know, the belief had been ingrained and entrenched in her mind that she should not come to us because she's impure and dirty and she should not be engaging with men.
Mm-hmm.
There were men in our group. Now, then you see other girls who are more involved in, you know, with the community mobilizers and the young female health workers, and maybe they are staying in school more, and they are challenging their families. They are, you know, raising their voices and saying, this is not right. I want to stay in school. I like being in school. I don't want to do this. So it really depends on the village itself and the education level there and the intervention and who, you know, are there local NGOs involved in the community work? And it just depends. And I would say girls can do are definitely more and more outspoken with, you know, social media, technology. It does have a part to play, and there's always a bad side of that, but more and more people have access to Facebook or the internet, and I do think that kind of affects what people see as normality. I will still say, though, that changing the actual mindset is a long battle, and that will come with generational change. You know, the younger women, and they're not going to enforce these traditions and customs on their girls. So that's where the change will come. But the experience of the girl or the woman is really unique and tied to their upbringing and their families and probably where they grew up just physically in terms of location.
Maybe some of this can begin to change with the use of virtual reality technology. I watched the excellent video prepared by WaterAid, Aftershock, and the story of the plumber, Krish, I believe is his name, and it's following the devastating earthquake. And I looked at some of the pictures, and some of the pictures certainly of the you know, the villages and the homes, they're jarring. But I think what would be equally jarring is to see these pictures of many of the village members with these virtual reality goggles on. The goggles you're making available free in order to watch this video, and it's an app, and it's really fantastic. Could you take a second and just tell us a little bit about this and what it's meant to you, and maybe even kind of the strategy behind it? Because I do think that as some of us who might not get to Kathmandu or to, you know, the remote parts of Nepal, we can still experience it, and maybe this virtual experience might accelerate our understanding.
Absolutely. I would say that it's absolutely revolutionary, because for so many of us, well, I fortunately have had the opportunity to go to these districts, but imagine for people based here right in New York City, to be able to go into a community or a home and see what is exactly going on and see firsthand the situation, the conditions, it's mind-blowing. So
I was blown away. I thought it was just fantastic.
Right. I don't know if you've been to Nepal.
No.
But exactly. So it gives you a real understanding and firsthand view of what's happening and the context. And I think it's incredibly powerful, because not all of us are going to get to these communities. Mm. And even for people in Kathmandu, they're not going to get out to the far west in their lifetime. No way. So it opens your eyes to the realities on the ground and in these very marginalized, isolated communities, not only for people, you know, in the U.S. and around the world, but for people in their own countries. And maybe they can start advocating for their women and girls when they better understand the conditions. So the strategy is just to demonstrate and show what people are facing and tell the story in a powerful way so that people can understand and get involved and really fully have a view of what's happening in reality.
It really is a wonderful device, just very, very impressive, as is all the work that you're doing, Cecilia Shrestha. We're grateful for that. Our thoughts are with these young women, and certainly our thoughts this time of year are about how to help organizations like yours. So we'll put up links. We certainly are going to give lots and lots of access to where our audience can find WaterAid and find you and read about some of the work that you're doing. But Cecile Shrestha, this is a tough subject, and you really just, you all are handling it so well. We're very appreciative of your time today, and I want to give you just a moment more to tell us what we can do.
Thank you, Paul, so much for having me. It really is the issue I feel very connected to, you know, being both Nepali and American. What you can do is, I think the first step is, again, start talking about the issue and better understand it, and really entrust yourselves to organizations like WaterAid who have worked in these communities for years. WaterAid Nepal has been working in these communities since the 80s, so they really understand what's going on. They are best placed to do the proper intervention. So really, just educating yourself, talking about these very difficult issues. No one wants to talk about it. It requires getting outside the box, having the courage to talk about it, and then spreading the awareness and supporting the right people on the ground to do their job to overcome these, you know, injustices in time.
Well, thank you very much for all of your courage, for your candor. We're going to do our best to support WaterAid as much as we possibly can. Cecile Shrestha, Director of Philanthropy at WaterAid, thanks again. And we certainly are going to be following up, and we're going to be looking in to see what more we can do at some future point. But thank you very much, Cecile.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks so much.
Appreciate your time.
Okay, yours. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.